Hello and welcome to the Plain English Cybersecurity Podcast. In this podcast, we aim to make cybersecurity understandable for everyone, and we try to explain things in plain English. This is episode number 4 of our podcast, and I'm your host, Eric English. And sorry for the little hiatus. I did take a vacation, so that's why I skipped a couple of weeks, but we're jumping back in here into episode 4. In this episode, we're going to primarily cover data protection and data privacy. And to recap our previous episodes, episode number 1 was primarily just a basic introduction to cybersecurity, some of the common terms, the CIA triad, fun stuff like that. We also talked about common threats and attacks like malware, viruses, trojans, ransomware, social engineering, insider threats, all those kinds of fun things. Episode 2 was around best practices, so multi-factor authentication, software updates, patch management, endpoint protection, fun stuff like that. And then last episode was about networking concepts. So we talked about basic networking, we talked about DNS, IP addresses, ports, protocols, firewalls, IDS, IPS, zero trust, all those fun buzzwords. So now we're talking about data protection and data privacy. Now, this is a very broad topic and can be extremely in-depth. And so I'm going to try to keep it as high level as I can and try to be as, you know, basic as I can and explain all the nitty-gritty details here. Again, in plain English, as best we can, I'll try to use analogies to explain all the various things that we're going to discuss today. So first thing, when it comes to data protection, the first thing that I think about when I think about data protection is encryption. Now, encryption is a very common thing nowadays, thankfully. In the early days of the internet, encryption was just kind of sporadically used. And nowadays, it's very, very commonly used, thankfully, because we're doing a lot more with the internet nowadays. We have a lot of sensitive data. We're accessing sensitive websites, our bank website, whatever it is. All those things need protection, right? We need to protect that data because it's very sensitive to us. So how do you protect the data? You encrypt the data. So when it comes to encryption, what does that word mean? It is a way to basically protect the data that you are transmitting or storing or creating. So you want to encrypt or protect that data. So encrypting is a way of basically making it look like the data is just a bunch of junk, really just scrambled junk that makes no sense at all, unless you have the key to decrypt that data. So you can encrypt it and then decrypt it with a key or a certificate, however you have it set up. But effectively, what you're doing is you're scrambling the data in such a way that it's safe to transmit it over the public internet, because if you don't encrypt the data and you send it over the public internet, then people can intercept that data and they can read the data. And that's what you don't want, especially with anything that's sensitive. So you want to try to encrypt any kind of sensitive data. So that's kind of step one, is encrypting the data, making sure that it's secure, not only in transit, but when you store the data, or they call it at rest, when the data is resting wherever it lands, you want to make sure that it's encrypted and protected there as well. And also too, you know, you want to make sure that, you know, when you're transmitting the data, it's encrypted, you're storing the data, it's encrypted, but also when you're creating the data, you're creating it in such a way that it's secure as well. So you can create data and immediately put it into some sort of encrypted containers, all kinds of different ways to do it. Or you can enter data like into a secure web portal, whatever it is, right? But when you think about going to like your bank's website, it's HTTPS. That S stands for secure, right? And you are basically transmitting data to and from that bank website securely using encryption. And that's specifically using certificates. There's a lot of different forms of encryption, lots of different encryption algorithms that we're not going to dive into today because there's way too many. But essentially, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do it. There are some older encryption algorithms that are no longer secure you want to avoid. But, you know, all the new modern stuff is secure enough for now. And I say for now because quantum computing is coming very, very quickly, and it's going to make a lot of our encryption obsolete here really, really soon. So let's hope that doesn't happen, but they are starting to come out with quantum-resistant encryption. That's kind of a new form of encryption that's been coming out here lately. And they're just trying to get ahead of the curve so that when, you know, quantum computing is mainstream, that people aren't able to just decrypt anything and everything that they want. So quantum-resistant encryption is kind of the new frontier of encryption. But you'll hear keywords like plain text. Plain text is exactly that. It's unencrypted data, just plain text in a document, for example. So that's plain text. And you have your, of course, you have your encryption algorithms. You'll hear those words a lot. Basically, an algorithm is just a mathematical formula or a process, if you want to call it that. And that's used to transform that plain text document into what they call ciphertext or the encrypted form, right? So some really super common encryption algorithms are things like AES or RSA or DES. You'll hear triple DES and stuff like that. Those are very, very common. Now, again, not all of those are secure anymore, but those are just a few kind of right off the cuff that I can think of. And I also mentioned the encryption key. That is what you use to encrypt and decrypt the data. Now, when you use the same key for encryption and decryption, that's called symmetric encryption because you're using the same key, right, to encrypt and to decrypt. Now, you have also what's called asymmetric encryption, and this is using a pair of keys, like a public key for encryption and then a private key to decrypt. So you'll see that oftentimes with your websites that you go to. The website's going to present a public key to you, and then you can decrypt it with a private key. So anyway, those are kind of just some very, very generic terms that you'll hear when you hear encryption and data protection and things like that, and decryption and ciphertext and all that. So those are just a few of the common buzzwords that you'll hear. But let's talk about sensitive data. What is sensitive data? Well, it's whatever you define as sensitive. So it could be company secrets. It could be trade secrets for your business. It could be your personal data, such as your social security number, your home address, your phone number, your bank account number. Anything like that is sensitive data. Or if you are, let's say you're an inventor and you're inventing something that, you know, is super secretive that no one can hear about, well, that's sensitive data. If you're creating whatever it is on a computer or even writing it down for that matter, that's sensitive data. And even if it's in paper form, you still want to secure that paper, those paper documents somehow. You want to put them in a locked drawer somewhere so that way it's not accessible by everyone without a key. So encryption's kind of doing the same thing, right? You're locking it up. You're locking up that data with an encryption key, and then you're transmitting it to wherever it needs to go. And you're either storing it, whatever, you're opening it, whatever it is. If you're opening it, then you're going to use that encryption key to decrypt, unless, again, you're using asymmetric. But anyway, I really want to emphasize that sensitive data is whatever you think is sensitive, right? You have common types of sensitive data, like personally identifiable information, which would be like your social, your driver's license number, stuff like that. But if there's something else that's near and dear to your heart, that could be your form of sensitive data, right? It doesn't have to be PII. It could be, you know, anything that you define, right? So that's when you get into what's called data classification. So data classification is where you tag that sensitive data and you say, hey, this data here is sensitive. And I want to make sure that anybody that, you know, looks at this data understands that it's very sensitive in nature. It is not to be shared and it needs to be protected or encrypted. So data classification helps you kind of define what is sensitive data for your business or for your personal life, whatever you're doing this in. And that way you know, hey, anything that meets this criteria is sensitive data, right? So if it's got my name, address, and phone number in it, that's sensitive data. If it's got my driver's license number, that's sensitive data. And you could also think about pictures as being sensitive, right? If you've got a picture of your driver's license. That's sensitive data, right? It doesn't have to be text all the time. It could be a database. It could be, you know, you name it. Any kind of data, doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be a text file, right? So any kind of data can be sensitive data. So anyway, you want to protect that data. You want to encrypt that data and make sure that, you know, only the people that you want to access that data have access to it. And then you also have a concept called data loss prevention, or DLP. And DLP is exactly what you think it is. You're preventing data from leaving or being lost or stolen. So how do you prevent data from being lost or stolen? Well, typically that is, you know, how, where encryption comes into play. If someone steals a bunch of encrypted data, all right, cool, good luck, you know, have fun trying to decrypt that. Now, if they go bust out a quantum computer, well, then they might be able to. But regardless, you know, nowadays, at least right now, today, if you encrypted a bunch of data and you know it's encrypted and that encrypted data gets stolen, the likelihood that it gets decrypted anytime soon is unlikely. Now, that's not to say that in 10 years, that data would not, you know, it could be very well decrypted in 10 years, because by then, guess what? We're going to have quantum computers much more mainstream than they are currently, and it'll be a lot easier for people to decrypt any kind of data like this. So for now, though, stealing that encrypted data is basically useless, so that's why you encrypt your data. They also have mechanisms where if someone takes that encrypted data or takes data, or they try to take data outside of a network, right? For example, they try to put it on a USB drive. Well, as soon as they plug in that USB drive to their computer, what that person doesn't always know is that in some cases, that USB drive now becomes encrypted. And so anything you put on that USB drive is encrypted. So if you leave with that USB drive, it is now encrypted and basically useless unless you have a way to decrypt it. So data loss prevention is very much about protecting that sensitive data, encrypting that sensitive data, making sure that it doesn't fall into the wrong hands. So that's where DLP comes into play. Okay, so what are some other ways to protect your data? Well, there's always making a backup of your data, making copies of that data. That way, if a system crashes or gets hacked into or whatever, you've got a backup. Now, the key here is to encrypt those backups as well, because oftentimes threat actors, as they call them, will, once they get into your network, they try to go after your backup infrastructure. They try to go after your backup systems that create and store all the backups, because that's where the crown jewels are. You're backing up all your data to these backup servers. If I'm a bad guy and I get access to that, all right, cool. Now I have access to all your sensitive data in one place. So encrypting that data is very, very important. So when you do make a backup, make sure that it is encrypted and highly encrypted at that, just to make sure that if it does get stolen, again, who cares? They stole a bunch of encrypted data. Good luck getting it. So backups are very, very important to help with data protection and data recovery as well. And you've also got things like secure file sharing and, you know, secure destruction of files and things like that. So let's talk about secure file sharing first. This is a very, very tricky subject, because nowadays there's all different kinds of services to share data. You can use Google Drive, you can use Dropbox, you can use OneDrive, you can use Box.com. There's so many different ways to share data. Well, how in the world are you supposed to protect all that? That's where data protection becomes very, very, very difficult, because you have your end users just sharing data and not always following best practices as far as security goes. This is where data protection gets very, very difficult. So oftentimes what you have to do with these cloud-based services is you have to connect into the API oftentimes and use the API to try to figure out what people are sharing, how they're sharing it, who they're sharing it with. Did they share it publicly, right? Or did they share it with one or two people like they're supposed to? Creating public shares is very, very scary, because that means anyone on the internet with that link can access whatever that data was. So those file sharing services are very, very tricky and hard to protect and hard to manage. So for security professionals, oftentimes we plug into the API of those services and try to do the best that we can, but it's still very, very difficult. So the only real way around that is to try to train your employees to not share everything in the world. Only share what you absolutely need to. And even then, if you're going to share something, try to encrypt it. Put a password on it. Password protect it. Whatever it is, especially anything that's even remotely sensitive. Or just make sure that you share it to, you know, a limited number of people and not to the entire public internet. And then data disposal, this one is very, very tricky because you go to your computer right now and you delete a file that's on your desktop. You think, oh, it's gone, right? And then you delete it from your recycle bin. Oh, it's definitely gone, right? For sure. Actually, it's not. The only thing that you did was delete the index from where that file was originally stored. It has not been overwritten, and so therefore it can still be recovered with forensic tools. So to really securely destroy data, you have to do several data wipes and data overwrite and, you know, delete and overwrite and delete and overwrite in those sectors on that hard drive to make sure that that data is really and truly deleted. Otherwise, forensics tools can be used to recover all kinds of data from those hard drives, and you'd really be shocked how far back they can go. But there's a lot of different tools out there that will help you with, you know, wiping the drive, you know, DOD type wipes, which is Department of Defense. Do a DOD wipe on the hard drive and do several passes of that DOD wipe. So you don't just do it one time, you do it 20 times to make absolutely sure that there is nothing left. Because some of these forensic tools are amazing at recovering data. It's very scary what they can pull from a hard drive. So securely destroying data is a totally different world and a totally different ballgame. And it takes very specialized tools to truly securely destroy any kind of sensitive data. Last thing to talk about today was privacy. And this is a massive topic that probably can barely just scratch the surface of. But, you know, most people don't think about their privacy nowadays in the world that we live in with social media and things like that. We don't think about the ramifications of sharing whatever you just shared on Facebook or on Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it. Any kind of social media platform where you're sharing anything about you is very detrimental to your personal privacy. Now, there are other parts of privacy that are even more scary, because if you purchase a home, well, the tax records for your home have your name tied to that home and that street address. So now all people have to do is go look at tax records and they can find where you live, your name, your street address, everything about you, how much you bought the house for. All that kind of stuff is essentially public data. And that's where privacy is so important. You've heard probably GDPR is one of the big privacy frameworks in Europe. And then in the United States, we have a few that individual states are trying to create, like CCPA is the California Privacy Act. And so we are trying to become more privacy focused, and you're seeing a lot more of these, what they're calling end-to-end encrypted messaging services. You can think of things like Signal or Wire. Those are end-to-end encrypted. And what does that mean? So that means that if I have Signal, the app Signal, on my phone, and you have the Signal app on your phone, we can connect and communicate back and forth. And anything we send from one end to the other is what they call zero knowledge. So even though that data goes through Signal's servers, it's so encrypted that nobody can decrypt it. And this is exactly what you want. You want that zero knowledge and end-to-end encrypted services to really help protect your privacy. They also have services like ProtonMail, where it does a very similar thing, but via email. Now, here's the trick with ProtonMail. If you email, let's say you have a ProtonMail account, and you email somebody at Gmail, well, guess what? You think, oh, this is super secure because it's ProtonMail, it's encrypted. No, it's not. Because it's going to Gmail, it is no longer encrypted. Once it gets to Gmail, it's no longer encrypted. So this is where you have to be very, very cautious with email specifically. And to protect your privacy, you want to communicate with somebody who also has a ProtonMail account. And as long as you keep it within those ProtonMail accounts and ProtonMail servers, ProtonMail has no idea what you're sending back and forth, nor do they have the ability to read it because it's end-to-end encrypted. It's zero knowledge, meaning ProtonMail has zero knowledge of what data you are transmitting. They have zero knowledge of it. They cannot decrypt it. They cannot see your data. They cannot inspect your data. They don't know what it is. All they know is there's just a bunch of encrypted data going back and forth. That's the only thing that they can see. And that's the kind of thing that you want to really help protect your privacy. And to really, if you really want to deep dive into privacy, and I would highly recommend at least starting the journey, right? Because privacy, to be fully private in this digital world, it is a journey to get there. It takes a long time. One of the things that you should do to help protect your privacy right out of the gates today, if you don't already, go and freeze your credit at all three credit bureaus today. And you can do all of this online via their website. And by the way, it is free. Do not let Experian or Equifax or any of those folks try to charge you some membership fee. Don't pay for that because it is 100% free to freeze your credit. So go to the three major credit bureaus and freeze your credit. Now, there are more than three credit bureaus. However, the big three, TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian, are the big ones that you want to freeze your credit at. And again, you can do all this online for free. And this does not affect any accounts that you already have open. What this does is it prevents any new accounts from being opened using your name. So as you may hear about in the news all the time, there's some sort of a breach or some sort of a hack where Social Security numbers were stolen, right? Well, in that case, if someone has your Social Security number and then they go look at your tax records and say, oh, I know where you live now too. I've got your home address. I got your phone number. I've got your Social Security number. I got your birthday. I got all these things. They can now go try to open an account in your name, a line of credit in your name. They can try to get a mortgage in your name. And this is where you have to protect yourself, right? You don't think about your credit as being part of privacy, but it very much is. It's protecting your identity, right? You want to protect your identity every which way you possibly can. So that's why freezing your credit is step one of privacy, of your privacy journey. From there, they have data removal services that you can pay for, or you can do it yourself. But basically, you Google your name and see what comes up. And there's a lot of these data brokers that go and collect information about you, and they sell it to marketing people. They sell it to whoever wants to buy it, really. And these data brokers make tons of money on your personal information. However, by law, they are required to remove your data if you request it. So that's where these data removal services do come in handy. However, to truly remove all of your data from the internet is very, very difficult because, you know, you can remove it today, but then in 4 weeks, they're just going to publish that data again, those data brokers, or some new data broker comes online with the same data. And you have to tell them, hey, remove my data. So these data broker or data removal services will go out to all those new data brokers and remove your data for you. But some other strategies that I've found work quite well, opening a P.O. box and pay for the additional address service of the P.O. box so that you can use the physical street address of that post office and use the unit number as your actual P.O. box. So let's say the post office is located at 1234 Main Street and your P.O. box number is 123. So what you can do is when you sign up for anything online, you can put in your home address as 1234 Main Street, unit number 123. That way, your real home address and real street address are not in everything that you sign up for. Because when you go sign up for stuff online, everything you sign up for wants what? Your email address, your full name, your phone number, your home address, right? They want all this data about you. And people freely give up this information, not even thinking about any kind of ramifications down the road. But this is what identity thieves use to steal your identity, open lines of credit in your name, and ruin your credit a lot of times. And then you got to go and try to clean it all up. It's a royal pain. And by the way, do not pay for any kind of credit monitoring services. You'll hear LifeLock is one of them. There are other credit monitoring services. Like, for example, when a lot of these, what was it, the Equifax breach that happened at the credit bureau. What did they do? They offered credit monitoring services to everyone that was affected. Well, guess what? Credit monitoring doesn't protect your credit. Freezing your credit protects it. Okay, so the difference here is when you are monitoring your credit, you have to leave your credit unfrozen so that new accounts can be created. And if they're monitoring that and they say, ooh, this account looks fraudulent, you still got to go and clean up that account because your credit wasn't frozen. But if you just freeze your credit, which is completely free, no one can open an account in your name, period. So I don't know why you wouldn't freeze your credit, but don't pay for those credit monitoring services because they actually ask you to leave your credit unlocked so that they can monitor. That doesn't do you any good. You want to freeze your credit, prevent any new accounts from being opened unless you're opening the account. And if you're going to go open a new account or go buy a new truck or a new car or whatever, all you got to do is go to those three credit bureaus, do a temporary lift of your credit freeze, unfreeze it for the day, and you're done. And then the following day it refreezes. Or just unfreeze it while you're applying for that new car and then freeze it again as soon as you're done. Right? It's very, very simple. It takes, you know, a couple of minutes to log into the site, click the freeze button, click the unfreeze button. It's very, very simple to do. And that way you can still go out and open new lines of credit in your name because it's you, but it prevents anyone else out there from doing that. So highly recommend freezing your credit. Highly recommend using some sort of a PO box with that street address service. It is an additional cost, right? And privacy does cost money, right? To these data removal services that are out there, that costs you money, right? To remove your data. But in the long run, it's going to protect your privacy a lot better. Some other strategies are to use aliases where you can, right? You don't have to use your real name. Not everything you sign up for needs your real name. Use an alias. Use a burner email address, right? So there's a lot of different ways. And also your phone number, I think, is probably the biggest thing that I don't think people realize. All those spam calls that you get, all those, you know, there's so many scammers out there that will call you on the phone and try to scam you out of your money. Well, how do they get your phone number? You plugged it into something that you signed up for online. And so now when that website that you signed up for gets hacked and your phone number gets leaked, well, guess what? Now the bad guys have a target and they're going to call you and they're going to try to scam you. But if you use a phone number, like a Google Voice phone number, for example, you could sign up for a Google Voice number for free. Use a Google Voice number when you sign up for these websites and then just never check it. You can actually still get your one-time codes and all that stuff, but you never have to answer any of those calls. And keep your actual phone number private. Don't give out your real phone number. Some other things that you can do, and I know I'm kind of going into the weeds on privacy, but this is one of my favorite topics, but cell phone service is one of those things that I don't think people realize is so public. It's not even funny because every time you sign up for a Verizon or whoever, AT&T, T-Mobile, anytime you sign up with them, they're also going to run your credit, but they have databases of all these people, all their personal information. And guess who's been hacked multiple times? T-Mobile. T-Mobile has been hacked multiple times. So has AT&T. Okay, so those carriers get hacked and there goes your phone number and all your personal data too. So anyway, there are some strategies for a cell phone, for a private cell phone. If you really want to go privacy focused for a cell phone, there are services like Mint Mobile, for example. It's a prepaid phone service. And when you sign up for this, you pay for the service in advance. It's going to ask you for a name and a phone number. You can give them any name you want, any address that you want, right? It doesn't matter. You're paying for it up front. They don't care what your name is. So you can go get Mint Mobile service. Say your name is Jane Doe. You live at 1234 Main Street. And they'll give you a SIM card. And you get your cell phone service, right? It's not a big deal. So things like that, I don't think people realize that you can do that. It's not illegal. It's not against the law. You're using an alias, yes, and that's fine, right? Go ahead and use those aliases and protect your personal information. It's very, very important to do so. So anyway, there's a really great book on privacy as well. It's by Michael Basil. And you can find it on Amazon. And I highly recommend checking it out if you want to start down this path of privacy, personal privacy. And he's got a couple of books, actually. But the one specifically is How to Disappear in America. And if you search that up on Amazon, you can find it. It's in paperback. And it's extremely valuable. He's also got a really cool website, IntelTechniques.com. And he actually goes through all the credit freeze stuff, and he has a lot of amazing tips and tricks for privacy-focused people. There's also an Android operating system that you can install on like a Google Pixel phone if you really want to get really into the weeds on privacy. So anyway, there's so much that you can dive into on the privacy side. I'm going to stop there, but freeze your credit at the bare minimum. Try to use aliases where you can. Use burner email addresses, burner phone numbers. Don't give away your real information. It's not required half the time. So anyway, just protect your own personal data, and that will in turn protect your privacy. All right, folks, that's enough for today. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll be back next week with our next episode.